so hype right now. Anything's possible. Anything's possible!
RSD Renegade Radio. Where real guys talk real sports. Allow me to introduce the illustrious three-man booth.
I want winners.
What's your name, boy?
Mark the Game Changer.
What's your name, boy?
D-Well.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
CLT Sports PhD.
The world famous.
Ray.
They are who we thought they were.
We need more dollars.
RSG. Renegade Radio. The floodgates is about to open.
Everybody has an opinion.
A man must have a code.
We're taking RSG to the next level.
Hello. You play to win the game.
You could gripe about Mike's game, but I don't see shooting percentage getting it.
I mean, I'm not griping the third overall player on my list.
In the face!
Now, I blame it on Nintendo. It's provocative. Excuse me, we don't make excuses. You know, we're not going to make any excuses.
You need to move more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. Can't wait. Can you dig it, sucker?
I am your host, Mark is a Game Changer, and one-third of the illustrious three-man booth. This is, again, the Renegades of Sports Radio, here to hold you down for the next 2 hours this evening. We have a slamming show scheduled for you all, so just sit back, relax, take it all in, and enjoy the ride. Now, before we get into the logistics and the specifics, allow me to introduce the other two-thirds of the illustrious three-man booth. To my right, I got my man, D. Wills. Holla at the people.
You know, I'm excited. I'm just going, you know, I'm going to stay away from the referees. I'm going to keep my distance. But I'm here to play hard. But I don't want to get ejected.
We say both teams played hard. C. Wallace. On my left, I got my man. He's going to be dissertating all night. Phil T, Sports, PhD. What's going down?
Reginald Rondo, I got this for you.
Cannot play with him. Cannot win with him. Cannot coach with him. Can't do it. I want winners. I want winners.
Oh, man. Yeah, that Rondo's a young hothead. He is definitely a young hothead. We're going to get into that plus much more tonight. Right now, I'm going to hit you with the intro to let you know. We're going to go through the rundown of the show that we got for you tonight. During the funky editorial, we're going to hit you off with some NBA playoff talk. We're going to get into Rondo, Amare, Derrick Rose, the Mavericks Thunder series, the Clippers Grizzlies series. So we're going to get into all those great series in the NBA playoffs. The thing we like to call the spring classic around these parts. We're going to get into that during the funky editorial. We're going to pick up where we left off with the top five hip-hop songs of all time. Each of us came up with a list of the top 20 songs. We're at our top five, so we're going to go five through number one. So these conversations have been really heated, really contested. And, you know, we've coined an RSG phrase around here through these conversations. You might hear Kat say it tonight, which is, hey, it's my list.
That's right.
That's right.
And I had to copyright that to my man PhD, man. A cat hit you with that, that means back off. Slow your roll, Scrappy. Slow your roll, Scrappy. I'm in control right now. That's what that means. We also will be joined by Northern Illinois head coach, head football coach Dave Dorn. He'll be coming on tonight to talk to us about the Northern Illinois football program, talk a little spring football. So that'll be a great conversation. So make sure you stay tuned for that. We're going to talk some NFL draft. And then we're going to get into a little bit of boxing. Yeah, we're going to talk some boxing. You know, we had the B-Hop fight over the weekend. He got it laid to him by Bad Chad, and Mayweather Cotto is coming up. So we got a lot of goodness wrapped into this 2 hours that we call the RSG, Real Sports Guys Renegade Radio Show. So make sure you stay tuned. If you so happen to not be listening right now, or if you know somebody who's not able to join us, tell them if they want to get on with us and they want to get on with the Real Sports Guys to hit us up at our webpage, www.realsportsguys.com, or to catch us on Facebook, at Real Sports Guys at Facebook, or on Twitter. All right, you can catch us in any of those three venues. We always talk smack. We keep it hot. We keep it jumping. So make sure you check us out on any of those formats. Now, and like we always do about this time, we are going to get into a little segment we call the Funky Editorial, where the three-man booth, we pick a topic, we go around, we editorialize, da-da-da-da-da, we keep it hot, whoop-de-woo, and we get it blazing, as we always do. All right, Real Sports Guy style, RSG, the Renegades.
Five, on the black-hand side.
Now, we really going to kind of go back and forth. We're going to allow a little barbershop style chatter on this one because we're talking NBA playoffs. And the NBA playoffs is something near and dear to the hearts of all of the three-man booths. This is a great time of year for us. We love the playoffs. This is where, you know, legends are made. You know, legends are made in the playoffs. You build your legacy. You make a name for yourself in the playoffs. You know, a lot of guys have made millions of dollars off of playoff performances. I'm looking at you, Jerome James. You know, a lot of guys have made a lot of money off playoff performances. A lot of guys have made a name for themselves and burst onto the scenes in the playoffs, a la Tayshaun Prince a couple years back in the early 2000s, where he burst on the scenes after not doing a whole lot his rookie year. So the playoffs are where names are made, where people make reputations, also where reputations go to die, and hopes and dreams go to die in the playoffs. You know, sometimes we gotta break it out, you know, and let people know.
They are who we thought they were.
That's right. And sometimes they're not. And the playoffs is like that truth serum. It lets you know what you're looking at because you got the best teams in the league going against each other in the seven games, knock them down, drag them out series. So a few things I want to hit on. I'm going to talk to the guys on some talking points, and we're just going to go around the table and see what comes out. You know, we like to throw some things off the wall and see what kind of a painting we get. First thing on the docket, the Derrick Rose injury. First off, just let me say it broke my heart, man. Again, I say this all the time. I just want to see the best basketball I can in the time that I'm able to on this planet. I want to see the best basketball play that I can. And I hate injuries, especially serious ones, that could alter the way great players play. And I hope this isn't that. I hope this is just, you know, ACLs aren't what they used to be, where a cat got an ACL and he was done. He wasn't going to be the same. But nowadays, guys usually come back even stronger. I mean, it hasn't affected Blake. He had an ACL, and, you know, it ain't really affected his game none. Cat's explosive as all get out. But, you know, it definitely put a damper on the excitement around the playoffs. Everybody, I think, was looking forward to that Heat-Bulls Eastern Conference Finals matchup, and it may still happen because the Bulls are still a very good team without Derrick Rose. But it won't be the same without the reigning MVP involved. Now, we kind of talked about this, and we kind of bantered back and forth over text this week as to when the injury happened, as to whether or not the Bulls can stay in it. Are they still a championship-caliber team? So that's the question I want to throw out there. I'm gonna toss to the PhD first. Are the Bulls still a championship-caliber team without Derrick Rose in tow?
No, I don't think they are.
I thought that they were going to have a difficult time with the Celtics in the second round. But as it stands right now, the Celtics are having their own issues, to say it lightly. But, you know, we were communicating this weekend. I mentioned that in some ways, losing Rose won't hurt them as much as it would have last year, considering he only played in – he missed almost half the season, essentially. I think he played in 27 – or he missed 27 out of 66 games. So in many ways, this team is used to playing without him. There's no question they're a better team with him. But in some ways, you know, it might make a guy like Boozer step up and give the kind of production that we saw him give in Utah a couple of years ago. And so, you know, with Rose, great player, great young man, but in some ways I'm frustrated with him because it takes so many shots for him to get points. He's a great scorer. But oftentimes you see him with these 11 for 28 nights, 9 for 28 nights. You know, he gets his 25, but at what cost? And if this team continues to play solid defense and they get an extra, you know, 4 or 5 points from their top four scorers, you know, I think in some ways they might be able to beat a Boston. You know, they might be able to extend Miami to 6 or 7 games. But I don't think in any way that they get past the Heat and perhaps not even Boston.
D. Williams, what's your prognosis?
I think Phil hit it right on the head. I think they're going to play better than people anticipate because they've already demonstrated that they can adjust. I think sometimes in situations like this, they're talented enough that sometimes makes it difficult to figure out how you might game plan against them. And what makes them strong is defense and rebounding. Those are the elite things that make them strong, and they're still going to do that well. You know, the key is if they can get enough scoring, which they've been able to do. Lucas III has stepped up, and so they've had some folks step up and score in his absence. He is a closer, but I think it's going to force some of these other guys like Dang to step up and have to do things. So I think they're going to play much, you know, you're not going to sweep them out, and if they get beat, they're going to get beat in 6 or 7 games. And some of these other teams have enough warts anyway, so they're not locks. I mean, I think the team that is the prohibitive favorite over them that just is so far ahead of them right now because of that is Miami. But I think all these other teams that they might match up against have their own issues that I think are strengths. These other teams' weaknesses are strengths for Chicago. Are they going to win a championship? No, but I think they might be a little bit more formidable than people think.
Yeah, just to kind of rip off some things you guys are saying, I agree. I don't think that they're championship caliber. I don't think they're a championship caliber team. They're still a very good playoff team. I still think that they're going to compete in the playoffs. Do I think they can beat the Heat? Nah. I don't see that happening unless something crazy or fluky happens to one of the Heat players. I really don't see that happening. We all know that playoff games really come down to can you get buckets in the fourth quarter. And they don't have anybody who can do that. They don't have anybody. You know, watching Oklahoma City and Dallas last night, that was a conference finals series last year.
Yeah.
And to watch them play that in the first round, they're playing it like it was a conference finals right now. They're playing that series like it is a conference finals. And when you watch the first two games, both teams are struggling to get buckets down the stretch. And both teams have some of the most offensively gifted players in the league. When you talk about a Harden, as far as being able to create his own shot, a Russell Westbrook, a Kevin Durant, a Jason Terry, even an old Vince Carter, Dirk Nowitzki. All those guys have made a living off creating their own shot. And the Bulls don't have anybody of that caliber who has a track record of creating their own shot. Rip is a shot maker, but he's not a shot creator, if you get my drift. If you can get your rip set up, he'll hit a shot. He'll knock some shots down, and he'll make some clutch shots, and he'll get on a run for you. But he's not going. You're not going to iso rip. That isn't something young Rip did. Let alone 35 year old Rip. You're not going to iso rip on the wing. So that's really the big flaw I see in this team. I agree. But with that said, the rest of the teams, as D. Will's pointing out, the rest of the teams in the East are very flawed as well. So they have just as much of a chance as anybody to compete, but I really think they're all competing for second place. With that said, go ahead.
What's up with Scottie Pippen in his letter? What's up with that? For listeners that don't know, Scottie Pippen messed around and wrote a letter of encouragement and posted it on his website to the Chicago Bulls, encouraging them, hey, tough loss with Rose, but buck up and make it happen. You know, I just think Scottie's trying to remain relevant or trying to be relevant again. You see him on the front row, courtside, and all the games. Yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't feel right. What you guys think?
Yeah, Scottie's trying too hard, man. He just let it go, Scottie. Just let it go. You're great, man. You'll always be great. Leave it at that. You know, put the period on the end of it and just ride off into the sunset. Nothing else needs to be said. That's how I feel about it.
But I would say on the other side of it, I think immediately after the post-Jordan era, a lot of these guys weren't pulled back into the family where they have been. I think in recent years, there's been a lot of effort to try to re-engage, these Bulls greats, people who are part of that, those championship years. And so, yeah, it may not have been the right way to do it, but, you know, Celtics and Lakers have developed that brand, and, you come out and support in that way. And I think this is, you know, at least one voice of kind of that Bulls aristocracy that's trying to say something. But it's not the right mode or medium to do it. So the style, we knocking him for the way in which he did it, but I'm glad that at least he did it. He could have just, called some guys, got on the phone. And
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm not even knocking him. Yeah. I'm not even knocking him necessarily for it. I'm just saying, look, man, you got access to the locker room, man. You ain't got to write no letter. You just go talk to them cats, man. You ain't got to write no letter. You don't need to do that. Who writes letters in 2012 right. Anyway? For real. That's a 40. Just write a letter. Sit by Pony Express.
So you said he should have hit him with Twitter.
Oh, something.
Could have been a tweet.
To tweet at him, Show him you down, man. Get your Twitter page popping. Somebody tell Scotty to get his Twitter page popping, man. Step his game up. You gotta get your multimedia game on, man. Come on, Scotty. You're supposed to be the most multifaceted player in the world. And you write letters. Cat had a very diverse game, but he's still writing letters. You ain't got an iPad?
I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Scotty,
anyway.
I didn't unleash the game changer on you, Scotty. I'm sorry.
I'm going to leave Scotty alone because Scotty's one of my favorite players. One guy who I've always kind of been on the fence on is Rajon Rondo. Great player, few attitude problems here and there that have been fairly well documented throughout his tenure as a starting point guard at Boston Celtics. Got himself into trouble over the weekend, got himself suspended for a game, bumped the referee, arguing a call, got ejected from the game, will miss game two, well, is missing game two. Game two is in progress right now. They tried to trade him at the middle of the season, I think, because of this kind of behavior. Where do you rank? Here's the question. Which move was dumber, Rondo or Amari? who wins the idiot award between these two cats?
Only the game changer can ask the question with that. I'll take it. So the guy getting my toilet bowl award. You guys ever played the Gus Macker's growing up? You guys ever played the Gus Macker 3-on-3?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a rite of passage.
I mean, you mess around and lose your first couple of games, you get put not in the loser's bracket in a toilet bowl. Okay? And whoever won the toilet bowl, they got a nice trophy of a toilet bowl. A brass toilet bowl. So I'm giving my toilet bowl award to Amari Stoudemire. You know, Amari, you were on the cusp of an all-NBA top alpha dog last year before Carmelo came. And it's been a spiral since. You know, you're still a solid player, but we're not putting you in the same conversation as the elite. In the MVP conversation, when you had 8-9 straight 30-point games to start off the season last year, you know, and so, you know, I'm not going to sit here and talk about what happened to the young man and what he was thinking, but at the end of the day, leaders talk, but they also, you know, like their behaviors speak for them, and unfortunately, his behaviors are speaking things that he probably, you know, doesn't want to reflect him. So, yeah, he got frustrated, but come on, man. The playoffs, you've already missed time, which is part of the reason why they're 8 seed. Come on, man. That's it.
Hey, D. Wills, weigh in.
Well, I heard that he did it. Again, my big thing is that some of these cats lack mental toughness. You know, he came out with this swag about Miami. They've been struggling this year against them. And, you know, the difference in what's making, you know, we don't have some of these emerging leaders is these fragile egos, mental makeup that they have is very fragile. And Amari is exhibiting that. There's no reason for him to react that way. Yes, be frustrated, but what pushed you to swing and punch glass? So, I mean, something in your mind should have just been like, nah, I'm not gonna do it. I mean, it does it, but this is. This is the evidence of everything we already knew about you. And all he did was validate the criticism that he's been receiving. And as you most eloquently said, they were parading him around. And this year he's breaking his hand with glass and out of the playoffs. I mean, how far can you fall? And that is an issue for me. These cats have got to do more. And all they're doing is paving the way for Miami. That's all they're doing. But I don't even know where to go. I don't know what they do in New York. Because they two stars struggle from the neck up. They just struggle. It's not a talent thing.
Yeah.
That's not it.
So what do the Knicks do with him? I mean, dude's got
I think they
can move Amari with that contract.
Yeah, that contract. I don't know how they do it.
Man,
but they
the Bobcats ain't taking him. Kim Kardashian don't want Amari.
In the NBA, put like this. In the NBA, they're always takers. If you give John Konkak $1 million contract at a time where he don't need $1 million contract, in the NBA, they're always takers. It'll be a feat, but
I don't think there's no takers. I can't possibly see an owner or GM signing off on this guy with those knees.
They got to figure something out. I mean, they're trapped. They're trapped with him.
Much time on his contract left.
They're trapped with him because neither one of them. I mean, Carmelo or Amari. They're struggling with that mental makeup. And you know, Tyson Chandler is really the heart and soul. He's the one that has a championship spirit. Those other two don't have it. And, you know, and they, Carmelo and all them, you know, you get what you ask for. See, so these cats are going into free agency. Be careful for what you ask for. You're going to get more than what you can handle. Sometimes it's better to stay in Denver. Media don't really care. Hey, if you make it to the finals, most people are all right with it. New York is different. And so I don't know what they do. They're going to have to get out of it.
Yeah, they honestly need to figure something out, man. They honestly need to figure something out because you have a piece in Carmelo that you're not really sure if he is the key piece to a championship team. You have some young – they finally have some other assets on that team when you talk about a guy people may be interested in, Jeremy Lin, for a lot of reasons. He could play, but then there are also all the other reasons that come with you know, Jeremy Lin. You got Iman Shumpert, again, he tore his ACL, but he should come back from that. He's a young guy who has the potential to be one of the better defenders in the league on the perimeter. You still got Landry Fields. I think you got to keep – right now, the only player you can really depend on their roster is Tyson Chandler. He's had an amazing season.
That's it.
Shot almost 70% from the field. Excellent rebounder. Anchored the defense. Right now, that's really all you got. As great as Carmelo is, he just doesn't do anything else. He can get you buckets, but he doesn't do anything else. And I think he's at a turning point, man. Something's got to give with him. He had a great last month of the season. But again, that scoring doesn't always equate to wins. You know, I think you kind of talked about it when you talked about D. Rose, PhD, about how a guy, it's not just about scoring baskets. It's about how you score your baskets. It's about when you score your baskets. And it's about the impact that you getting buckets has. You know, if you're scoring baskets and ain't nobody else on your team touching the rock or in the floor of the game, you know, those baskets are kind of hollow points, you know. It seems right. Like the Knicks play better when Carmelo doesn't score a ton. When he does score a ton, they don't do as well. So that team went from seeming like it was going in the right direction. And, again, it just seemed like that. I think we – here at RSG, again, you listen to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, the Sports Radio Renegades. Here at RSG, we all kind of – Brown, remember D. Wills? Remember back when Amari signed with the Knicks? One of our very first shows. We had a cat from New York call in to kind of try and convince us that was a great signing. I would love to find that cat now. Especially after this fool that punched the fire extinguisher. I'd love to find that guy now if he still thinks the Amari moves was a great move, because I think we were all skeptical on it to begin with. And then, you know, I've always been not a fan. I've always been on the off the Carmelo bandwagon. And putting those two guys together, this is what happens when you have guys kind of like buddying up. You know, like, I want to play with you. That all sounds good, but guys aren't honest with each other. And when you don't have that honest relationship, you really shouldn't be trying to broker deals. You know what I mean? Because Amari and Carmelo may see each other out in public and be like, yeah, we should play together. But what doesn't happen, what isn't said, is that actually, man, you hold the ball way too long, and I need movement. I need to play with a good point guard. So yeah, we should play together. That's how the conversation should have went. But it don't go that way because they all want to be friends. This Knicks situation is bad.
You're hitting a really good thing that to get to, and that's about the middle makeup that is more important for us to be friends than for us to win. Because if my lens is about winning, then I see those things. But when it's about being friends and it's about our brand and how together we can elevate our brand, then you miss those key elements of what you need to win. You don't have that critical eye. And that's the part that you look at a lot of these young stars, you don't see them looking at that. Whereas I'll give D. Rose credit. It was like, we don't need you. right? So even with that criticism, he had that critical eye. That's why he went out there dancing in the All-Star game, you know, in intros. I mean, he's got that critical eye. He needs to build some other elements, but he's got that critical eye about, you know, I don't really need to buddy up with you, in the same way Kobe's always had that critical eye. So, you know, I think you're hitting it. That's not the lens they look through. And it's not about winning, because winning would tell you, you would have a critical eye. You would say, you know, hey, we can still hang out. It's like having a study group and you don't do well. Like, we can't continue to study together. You know, I love you. We can go eat. We can hang out. We can't study together. And, you know, and they don't have that kind of critical eye at all. It's because they don't look through a lens of what it takes to win.
GAZ, you had a different take, man. So, where are you going with this?
So I got an alternate take with Stoudemire, a.k.a. Stacks.
with authority.
Right. Stacks. So oftentimes, not us, but mainstream media, we criticize specifically basketball players, okay? Specifically, young African-American basketball players that make a ton of money are not caring enough. Perhaps this action of punching, like Devon said, punching glass, not logical, but perhaps what he did was a sign of how much he cared. And not wise, stupid, toilet bowl, but at the essence of it is he cared. What do you guys think about that thought?
Yes, I agree. He cared. At the essence of it, he cared enough to punch, to embed shards of glass, to force shards of glass through his hand with an immense amount of force as he tried to punch a fire extinguisher, which is made out of metal, which was on the other side of the glass. So he would have lost either way. But yes. It's a sign of caring. It's absolutely a sign of caring. Immature as hell, but a sign of caring. So it's very immature, but definitely a sign of caring. Something that I would say.
I would push back on that, because I don't know if he cared because he cared because he really wanted. Not to say he doesn't want to win. But I think it was more because he hasn't been able to close in on the stuff he talked about before the season started that is related to Miami. And his frustration was more about that than care. Because if caring means, care, if you care, you've been around long enough, if you really care, that even though D'Antoni was your coach, you would have put an emphasis on defense. Because Chandler did, even though he was his coach, Chandler still, even though he didn't talk about defense, Chandler still played defense, right? So caring not just results in actions where you punch through glass with a metal piece of stuff is on the other side of that glass. Caring is you demonstrate that you were willing to sacrifice those other things before doing it. Now, if you had demonstrated you were doing that, then punched the glass, now I'm saying you care. But you hadn't changed any of that other behavior first. And then, so now I think you just punched the grass because you haven't been able to fulfill or back up the words that you said early on. And all LeBron them are doing is just straight up just surgically just knocking you out.
Here's the other piece is that, you know, Amari, his nickname, you said it, PhD, his nickname is Stat. All right? This cat ain't been putting up no kind of stats. And so as much as it's caring, it's also a bit of frustration. I think Carmelo is the same way. I think both of these guys are very much image conscious, and with that being image conscious, they want their numbers. And if they're getting their numbers, if they're getting their numbers, and the team is losing, they can say, "Well, I'm getting my numbers. It's the other guys." But they're not even getting their own numbers,
That's right.
So they can't even blame it on the other guys at this point, and they have to shoulder that blame. And sometimes, man, this is what they wanted. They wanted that New York. They wanted New York. They wanted the lights of the Garden. And there's a lot of scrutiny that comes with it on the other side of that coin. And this is what you get. And, you know, you kind of got to live with it. And they have to get used to it. Amare is it ain't gonna get no easier because he's not getting any younger. His knees aren't getting any less creaky. His back is not getting any looser. It's not gonna end well. This movie doesn't end well for Amare. I think he winds up getting scapegoated in this situation, where whether appropriate or inappropriate, he's going to become the guy that they point to and say he's what's wrong with this team because he's making all this money and he's not producing. He's getting paid $16 million a year. And again, next time, you know, have the GM. That's what fan bases should do. If you're a fan base of the Renegades, have your GM call into the show, and we'll put him up on game. We could have told, you know, Donnie Walsh and Dan Tony that, nah, you really don't want to sign Amari right now. You know, they might not listen, but you know that the Renegades told them not to sign that guy, and they went against the Renegades. And you don't want to go against the Renegades. You don't want to go against the Renegades because we're right a lot. We're not always right, but we're right a good amount of time. We're about right more than we're wrong, okay? And Amari to the Knicks was a situation where I think we had that one right. Carmelo to the Knicks, I think we had that one right. Two moves that seemed like they were big-time moves, but were more fool's gold than anything. So that's the funky editorial for this week. We're going to touch base more on some of the NBA playoff talk in the after-hours section. So stay tuned to the show. Again, you're listening to The Real Sports Guys, Renegade Radio, www.realsportsguys.com. Another thing that's going on right now, there's a lot of spring football going on. Right, D-Wills? A lot of spring football going on out there, right?
A lot of spring football going on.
So, you know, as we do here, we like to keep you up to date on what's going on. Football is the number one sport in the United States. So we like to keep you guys abreast with what's going on, and we like to give you a sneak peek of some up-and-comers. So we got a special treat for you all tonight. I'm going to toss it to D-Wills, and he's going to give you a preview of what we have in store for you.
Well, we had the pleasure of interviewing Dave Doran, who's former defensive coordinator at University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Badgers, is now the head coach for Northern Illinois University, where the Huskies went 11-3 last year after starting out, I believe, 2-3. Went on a run, won in the GoDaddy.com Bowl. If you had a chance to watch the MAC championship, they were actually down, I believe, 21-0, and came back to win that and put them in a position to go to the bowl game. And so he's one of the up-and-coming coaches, I believe, in America. They have an amazing group of folks that they have coming in and returning. And then Chandler Harnish, who was drafted as Mr. Irrelevant, was the quarterback for that team. But I think he has an upside we'll talk about a little later. So here's the interview. Listen to it. We recorded recently, and this is incredible as part of our spring edition. You are on with the Real Sports Guys, College Football Spring Edition. We're on with the Northern Illinois University head coach, Dave Doran. Northern Illinois won the MAC championship in 2011 and went on to win the GoDaddy Bowl, winning over Arkansas State. This is an incredible start for Coach Doran, had the best winning start of any Husky coach in history. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, Coach.
Doing great, Devon. Thanks for having me.
Coach, you had, if I were to describe it, in an incredible first year as a head coach. You finished 11-3. You win the MAC championship. Then you win the GoDaddy Bowl over Arkansas State. But you started out 2-3. And it was in terms of just kind of establishing yourself, that might have been a tough period. Can you talk a little bit about your start and then what happened at the beginning of the season and what happened in terms of making that turnaround?
Well, it was a team that won 11 games the year before with a previous coaching staff. And I think, you know, when you have success, the hardest thing is to maintain that level of success. And I think our players early in the season probably thought they were a little better than they were. and had to get scarred. You know, we had to get scarred a little bit and get beaten down, kind of get a reality check that we've got to play perfect to win, and we've got to prepare the right way and have a chip on our shoulder just like they did the year before. And we had to go through that period, I think, to realize what it takes to be a championship team. And as a coaching staff, as a support staff, and as a team, I think it was a great eye-opener, and it really brought our players and coaches together because of the scrutiny that's involved with that kind of start to your season.
Now, Coach, full disclosure, I'm a Husky alum. I was watching that MAC championship game. You were down 20. I turned the channel, turned back, and you were had an incredible finish, and you were celebrating. What did you tell your team to turn that game around?
Well, you know, fortunately, we had a really tight-knit group of guys, and this school had not won a championship in 28 years, and the year prior they lost the championship in the fourth quarter on a 4th-and-21 play. And so there was a lot of conversation for the entire year leading up to that point about getting back to Detroit and handling our business when we get there. And so it was pretty simple to walk in the locker room, and basically all I said is, hey, guys, you know, is this really why we came back here, to hand the game over? Because we're not even playing. And everyone just kind of looked at each other and started talking, and I really didn't have to say a lot. A lot of the players took over from there and just said, play the game. Don't have any regrets the next 30 minutes. You've got enough of them already in 30 minutes to last the season, and let's do what we came here to do. You know, and the guys did it. And it's really, this game is so much about not beating yourselves, and we really beat ourselves in the first half a lot. You know, turned the ball over 4 or 5 times, and the defense kept us alive, and thankfully in the second half, we played all 3 phases.
Coach, Chandler Harnish is an NFL prospect, an incredible player. Can you talk a little bit about what Chandler would need to do to be successful at the next level?
Well, Chandler's, first of all, is extremely intelligent and competitive. You know, I mean, he got his degree in business in 3.5 years. He almost finished his master's while he was still playing here in business. And very spiritual young man, carries himself the right way, does everything the right way on and off the field, and he's had to go through a lot of adversity through injuries, and I know he has everyone's respect on our campus, both academically and athletically and socially. I think the guy probably leads the world in community service hours. Just does things the right way and has a lot of karma. And on top of all that, he's very talented. I mean, he's 6'3 and 220-some pounds, and he can run, and, you know, he's competitive. The best thing I can say about Chandler is he's probably the best pressure quarterback I've been around. He didn't necessarily play well early in games, but when the game was on the line, he always played his best.
You said something that I think is, and most people may not know about you. You, as a student athlete, did it academically. I believe you're a pre-med. Academics is something that you value. Your team, in terms of its academic performance, is pretty highly ranked nationally. You place a very strong emphasis on what it means to be a student athlete. When you think about the type of player that we think about, we start to transition to some of your returning players, but also some of your prospects and the kind of player that you look for that values academics, that values being played at the top level. Talk a little bit about your philosophy and where education plays and the type of player that you're looking for when you're recruiting for your program.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was an academic All-American. I did get my undergrad in pre-medical biology, which is always a you know, funny conversation with recruits. But it goes to show you need to keep your options open. But
that's right.
You know, our team here is 3rd in the country in APR, which is how they measure college athletics academically. We're one of the only out of the 120 football schools in Division I, there's 12 of us with a 90% graduation rate, and we're one of them. And so there's a lot of good things going on here, and many of those things were in place, you know, when I got here, and so I've been fortunate that way. But we try to recruit guys that are career-driven. Obviously, we want great football players that know how to win, but we want guys that also understand that football is going to end someday, and they've got to do everything they can to put their life in the best possible place they can by choosing academic paths over social paths when the time is right. And that's hard, you know, especially today. And so there's a lot of research that goes into it. You're not always taking guys that can get into Harvard, you know. But you're taking guys that want the degree and that prove that, you know, by their work ethic and your conversations and the people around them. And, you know, you don't always bat 1,000, but that's a big conversation piece that we have with our coaching staff. You know, I get a lot of film from our coaches about why they want to coach guys, and the first question that comes out of my mouth is, how's he going to do in school here? And the second one is, what's his character like? You know, and those are real conversations we have, and I've turned down a lot of players because I didn't like the answers to those two questions.
You're on with the Real Sports Guys. We're on with Dave Doran, head coach of the Northern Illinois Huskies. He, his team was 11-3. They won the GoDaddy Bowl last year. They are on the rise. Can you talk a little bit, before I hand it over to Phil, can you talk a little bit about some of your recruits that you have coming in this year?
We signed 23 players to scholarships, and I want to say we have 8 or 9 guys that we've asked to walk on as well. They're joining us, and you know, it was a big class. Especially on the offensive side of the ball, there's 5 scholarship offensive linemen coming in, and we got 2 big tackles up there from Wisconsin, Josh Ruka and Levon Myers, that we need. We had 4 senior linemen last year, so this past year was a big recruiting class for our offensive line. And local player Scott Taylor, that we think is going to be a really terrific player. And, you know, we've got 2 big running backs, 2 good running backs from the Chicagoland area coming in, Perez Ford, who's the bigger type back, and Keith Harris, who's more of a compact-sized guy. You know, for our offense, we're pretty fast-paced. We rotate a lot of guys in and out. We got a really good tight end from the Chicagoland area named Desroy Maxwell. Probably the most touted guy we signed was a receiver from Vero Beach High School named Charlie Miller, that we think has the ability to play right away. So we're, you know, happy with that. Defensive line, we've got 2 big defensive ends, both 6'5 kids, and 2 big defensive tackles that are almost 300 pounds. So, you know, pretty excited about that. We did get a junior college defensive tackle named Ken Bishop that's here already, that is in our first string and playing extremely well. Probably was the biggest difference maker defensively this spring on the field for us.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys on RealSportsGuys.com. We're talking to Coach Doran, the head coach of the Northern Illinois Huskies. Coach, you just had your spring game this past weekend. Talk a little bit about how your spring practices went.
Well, they went really well. You know, we were blessed with weather. And we just broke ground Saturday at our spring game for our indoor football facility, the Chesick Performance Center, that's going to open in August of 2013. So that was a big step, but we don't have it yet. So we practice outside, and if the weather's good, we have a really good day. And if it's cold, it's a good day to run the ball, you know. And so we were lucky this spring because we had a lot of great days. And I think our kicking game really improved because we were able to be outside every day and not have high winds and cold weather. But it was good. You know, our guys know the system now. They've been with these coaches for their second year, and so they're not learning a system. They're just getting better at fundamentals and trying to improve their weaknesses.
Coach, you got 19 starters coming back, including a couple of key guys who missed the 2011 season due to injury. You opened
the season
with a very high-profile matchup against Iowa at Soldier Field in Chicago. Talk about that matchup and what that's going to mean to your program.
Well, you know, Kirk Ferentz is a guy that I look up to in this profession. I think he's, you know, one of the guys that every year he's got his team ready to play. I mean, Iowa's always competitive. They always are physical. They're always very fundamentally sound. And they're tough, you know. And so whenever you play the Hawkeyes, you've got to be ready for that kind of game. And so it's a great game for us to open up with because it's about fundamentals. It's not about flash and, you know, how you look. It's about what you do and how hard you do it and how long you do it and not beating yourself. And so I'm really excited to play them. And every year when we played Iowa when I was at Wisconsin, it was a slugfest. And so I have a real good idea what we're in for. And, you know, last year we opened up with Army and we spent all camp working on triple option. And that hurts your team a little bit, you know, because you don't see it all season. And Iowa's more of a basic team where a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are going to carry through the year. And I think that'll help us.
Well, Coach, definitely want to thank you for being on with us. Hopefully we can have you back before that Iowa game to check in with you. And we want to wish you well with your preparation for next year. And thank you for being on the Real Sports Guys.
Thanks for having me, guys. Go Huskies.
That was head coach Dave Doran, head coach of the Northern Illinois Huskies, won the MAC championship in the GoDaddy.com Bowl. He's on us with our college football spring edition. You listen to the Real Sports Guys. Back to the studio.
All right, and we're back. And again, that was Northern Illinois University head football coach Dave Dorn. Thoughts about that interview? Great interview. Again, thanks to Coach for coming on. Again, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. PhD, you had some insights. Why don't you share those with the people?
Yeah, I think Coach Dorn is one of the up and comers in college football. He's got that pedigree. You know, he's been to, I think it's 8 bowls, a couple of national championships at the 1AA level, and obviously he's a defensive coordinator at Wisconsin for a while. You know, if you look at this Northern Illinois job, it's somewhat like VCU in basketball, where you see these coaches, these up-and-coming coaches, they kind of build their brand there, and then they move on to more national jobs. You know, you look at Anthony Grant, when he was at VCU, and he moved on to Alabama. You know, at Northern Illinois, Kiel had some excellent seasons there. At Northern Illinois, he just recently moved on to Minnesota. And so what Coach Dorn is doing there, I think, is pretty interesting. They had a solid season last year. They lost Harnish, who, like you mentioned, was the last guy drafted in this year's draft. But don't be confused. This is the guy that was the conference MVP. Jordan Lynch has taken over for him at quarterback in their spring game a couple of days ago. He threw 400 yards, a couple of touches, had an outstanding game. And why that's so relevant is because their defense is going to be their strength this year. They're returning 9 starters from last season, plus they have 2 guys who started in previous seasons but were injured last year. So essentially they have 11 starters coming back on the defense. So I really like what they have going on there. And honestly, if you look at their schedule, they open up at a game at Soldier Field in Chicago where the Bears play, about an hour and 15 minutes north from DeKalb to Chicago. But it's not too far from Iowa either, so it's probably more of a neutral site game. I think if they can get past the Hawkeyes, they have a test against Kansas, and I think that's a winnable game. They're playing at DeKalb. They're playing home. Don't be surprised if this team runs the table. And we're looking at them as a 13-0 type of team because I think every game they play within the MAC, and the MAC is a good conference, solid conference. I think Northern Illinois can win every game they play in conference. So if they get past this Iowa team up front, watch out. So those are my thoughts on Northern Illinois. One last thought, you know, Coach Dorn talked about his recruiting philosophy, his focus on character. Those are pretty similar. We had his old boss, Coach Brett Bielema, on from Wisconsin Badgers a couple of weeks ago. He talked about the same thing. Hey, we might not always have a top 10 recruiting class, but we pick guys that are high character that are willing to fit into our system. And I think this is one of the reasons why Dorn has been so successful at Northern Illinois.
So I think you hit it right on the head when you talked about hearing a bit of that influence, that Bielema influence, and having some very common strains in the two programs. When you talk about the Wisconsin program and what they're trying to build in Northern Illinois, and I agree, man. I think this is a program that next year, you know, if they don't run the table, they're looking at 2 losses. They're looking at 2 or 3 losses. That Iowa game is going to be huge. It's a major game for the program. It's a huge profile-building game. Those are one of those games where, you know, you put your program on the map and you kind of usher in that new era that he wants to usher in. Very interesting to hear him talk about how they're trying to recruit into – how they're trying to really strengthen their recruiting base in the Chicago area but also reaching out into other areas. And you definitely hit on some really good things about – his principles. The MAC conference, quiet as kept, is a conference that has historically had a lot of good football. A lot of good football players have come out of that conference. I think Chandler Harnish, even though he was Mr. Irrelevant, I think he's going to be one of the Mr. Irrelevants that sticks in the league. There was a lot of talk about him going higher. That's a program that I think is going to continue to produce pro-caliber players. it's in a prime position. And I think, you know, he's going to get that program to a place where it's going to allow him to, you know, really begin to really, you know, you talk about building facilities and building the infrastructure to maintain a high-level program. I think he's going to continue to get that program going in a direction where you're going to see new facilities built. You're going to see new stadiums built, maybe a new football stadium built for that program, where now, you know, they're able to compete with, you know, some of the bigger schools in the Midwest as far as attracting football talent into their university. And maybe, you know, they're getting an invite into one of the major conferences in a couple of years. Because with realignment for the mid-major, it truly changes the way you develop your program. And I think Northern Illinois, they have the right mindset. They have the right they have a blueprint in place that they want to operate under. And I think Coach Dorn is really laying the groundwork for that program to be one of the top programs, not only at the mid-major level, but I think, you know, we're going to see them kind of start to creep up into the top 25 year in and year out when we look at the end of the season rankings. You know, they may not start there because it's very difficult for a mid-major to kind of break in the preseason, but throughout the season, I think we're going to see them begin to creep up into those rankings year in, year out. And it's going to be fun to watch because, you know, you heard of you got to hear about Coach Dorn and the Northern Illinois Huskies program on the Renegades. You got to hear with the Renegades first. So, again, a lot of appreciation to Coach Dorn. D. Wills, you have anything you want to weigh in before we move on?
First of all, I want to say Phil T. broke that down like a football version of Hubie Brown. So I just want to say that I listened to him and I was just like, he converted
Hubie.
Did he kill it? And I just want to say what you were saying. You know, what I caught is, and what I knew about this is, I mean, they're building a new indoor facility. So he understands the components that you need to have in place to begin selling your program and to be able to efficiently manage and create that indoor space and all the things that allow for you to create even that illusion of that you're building that big time program, that we have the facilities of Iowa, but we're in the MAC and selling it in a real way. So, I mean, he's already building those components with selling. He can raise money, which is a very important aspect of this. So I really like him. I love his answer to how they turned the season around. I had to let him get scarred up a little. I mean, that's a defensive guy. He just has something about him that I really enjoy when we talk to him.
Yeah, so, again, thanks to Coach Dave Dorn of Northern Illinois University, head football coach. Now we're going to transition. He talked about having his starting quarterback from last year, Chandler Harris, get drafted as the last pick in the draft, Mr. Irrelevant. Again, we don't think Chandler is going to be irrelevant at all. We think he's going to have a pretty decent career in the pros, and we think he's going to stick in the league. But we're going to use that as a segue. Coach gave us what we call a natural segue. We're going to use that natural segue to get into a little segment we call Five on the Black Hand Side. Here we go with that.
Five on the Black Hand Side.
Now, Five on the Black Hand Side, the real sports guys take five questions or five provocative statements, and we kind of go around the horn and each kind of weigh in on that particular statement. So this week, the topic that we're going to be bouncing around the table is the NFL draft. And the first question I have will be going to D. Wills. Which teams maneuver the draft process well? Now, let me clarify for the listeners out there. When we talk about draft process, we don't want to give grades, okay, because we won't know what this draft class really was for a team for another 3 or 4 years. So we don't want to give grades, but we do on talent and players. But what we do want to give grades on is how did you maneuver the draft itself? Did you move up when you had a chance to move up? Did you get the guys you wanted? You know, whether or not you properly evaluated those guys, that's yet to be seen. But did you move up to get guys you wanted? Did you make moves that made sense? Or did you give up too much to get a guy who may or may not help your team, who may not fit a need for your team as far as the structure of your roster? So those are the kind of things we're looking at. Not necessarily individual picks or how teams did with this group of picks, or we give this team an A or a B. Nah, we don't do that. We don't do that. We want to talk about how'd you do with the process of the draft. So, D. Wills, could you weigh in?
So the team, there's a couple of teams I like, but the team I'll focus in for this question would be the Buccaneers. They moved down and they got Mark Barron from Alabama, safety, and so they got a lot of value there. But then they picked up the guy that I think is going to be one of the most exciting guys. I think he has all the features you want in Doug Martin for Boise State. Who I think is this guy's a every down back, and I think you put him with LeGarrette Blount in the backfield. I think he's incredible, and Levante David from Nebraska. This guy will bring that kind of what we've known historically as the Buccaneer linebacking core. He has that kind of swagger around him. I think he can be a big upside around that. And so I think, in terms of just the picks, as you go down and look at their picks, it feels like they're going back to that old Buc. You remember, it seemed like the Buccaneers always made those solid picks. You mean, they're getting all these picks. And it seems like they're going back to that mold with a really strong emphasis on defense and rebuilding their defense. I like kind of how they maneuvered, but I think the biggest one is when they were able to trade down and still get somebody like Barron, who everybody believes is important. And the safety position is so critical to be strong up the middle in today's game because of the way that the offenses are running. To get a guy like that with his pedigree and then build that, come back with somebody like Doug Martin, and then you start thinking about David and you go down the line with some of the other players that they got. I think they had a solid draft.
PhD, who was somebody you felt like handled the process of the draft very well?
So somewhere Carson Palmer is his ears itching, his eyes burning, whatever.
That was my other team. My other team. Go get it.
Somewhere is burning because I think the Bengals had a great draft.
That was my other team, man. Go do it.
Yeah, I'm flying high with D. Wills' QB Brown reference. I'm flying real high right now. Just want to throw it out there. So the Bengals, I think, did a quality job. I like Kirkpatrick from Alabama. They picked him up in the middle of the first round, thinking he was 17 or 18. And this kid does everything well. Nothing particularly great, but everything well. And we've seen how Marvin Lewis can make above-average corners look solid. Look at Jonathan Joseph last year, or the couple of years before he moved on to Houston last year. I like this guard. I mean, it's tough to not fall in love with any lineman from Wisconsin, but the guard, Zeltler, they picked him up in the first round as well. Got that pick from the Raiders. And in the steal of the draft, for me, which made this be such a steal, was they picked up Devon Steele with the 53rd pick in the second round. I think this kid is a quality defensive tackle. He can play that three technique. You can move him out to rush on the end at times. And he's very solid against the run. So for those reasons, their first three picks, Kirkpatrick, Zelter, and Steele, I think are the reasons why I like the Bengals pick so strong. Again, they also picked up a kid late from Boise State, a free safety, George Ilka, and then Dan Heron, a kid from Ohio State, this is a guy I've always liked. He's a bit undersized for his running style, but I think in the right offense and the Bengals, their running game has struggled. I mean, House Shoes Benson, well, he went to jail a few times and missed a couple of games. He's getting his 20-25 carries. They're hungry to have a change of pace back there. So don't be surprised if Dan Heron picked in the sixth or seventh round makes a team and makes a contribution in the first year.
Excellent, excellent. So a team I thought did well with the process of the draft was the Indianapolis Colts. I thought they had a plan, and you could see what their plan was early on. You know, this team has probably been the most paid attention to this offseason, given the whole Peyton Manning saga. They announced earlier that they were going with Andrew Luck. And I think when you make a change like that, you have to put and you announce that you're going to basically let a legend go, which is what – I mean, they just let Peyton Manning go. You know, one of the top five quarterbacks arguably of all time, definitely the number one quarterback of this era. You let them walk. You have to have a plan in place, and whoever you're bringing in, you have to give that person every opportunity to be successful. And I think they did just that by going out and really getting weapons. They draft Andrew Luck first. They know that's what they're going into. Then your strategy has to be, what do we need to do to make this young man be successful? Understanding that, yes, their defense has some holes, but they said that our first priority needs to be, if we have what we think we have to give him weapons that he can grow with. Because that was what was beneficial to Peyton, is that Peyton came in and immediately developed a rapport with Marvin Harrison, Dallas Clark. Those guys he developed a rapport with, and he grew with those guys. Those guys then mentored other guys that he could grow with. When you talk about Marvin Harrison then grooming and Reggie Wayne being able to watch Marvin Harrison and Peyton work and being able to jump into that, then you have guys like Brandon Stokes who come into the situation, or Austin Colley or Pierre Garçon, and they see the environment. They see how these guys have grown together and worked together over a period of time, and they fall in line. And that's the kind of system that they want to continue to foster in Indianapolis. And I think in bringing in a guy, especially like Fleener, who Luck already has a relationship with, has a rapport with at that tight end position for a young quarterback, I think was an excellent move. And I think utilizing their first couple of picks to really go heavy on offense and try and get some additional weapons in there that are coming in with Luck and that can grow with Luck, I thought was a great strategy. Another team that I thought did a great job was St. Louis. I thought St. Louis was playing chess and everybody else was playing checkers. Because they're moving down, they're sliding up, they're sliding back, they're getting the guys that they want. They maneuver themselves into, I think, three or four picks in the second round and still manage the first-round pick. They got Brockers in the first round, the lineman from LSU, the D-tackle from LSU. And then they were able to fill needs. That St. Louis team is a team that maybe not this year. This year they could, again, depending on how things shake out in the offseason and the preseason with injuries and all that, that's a team that can win, you know, 8 to 10 games the next coming year. I think you were a year early on St. Louis, PhD. You were on them hot last year. I think you were a year early. But I think when we look back at this draft in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see some guys in this draft really making a difference on that team. And then that team is going to be a 12 to 14 win team. I think they have the foundation in place. Jeff Fisher is a guy that I love as a coach. He's won in Tennessee, even in years where you thought that they would be terrible. He's always had a competitive squad in Tennessee. He's always found a way to make his team competitive. He's always coached up his guys. So I think that St. Louis franchise is going in the right direction. You know, they may not even be in St. Louis in a couple of years, but that Rams franchise is really made some moves that were impressive this weekend. Now, going into number 2 and 5 on the Blackhand side. Good value picks. And with value picks, we mean good players who were taken a lot lower than maybe you had them graded at or you know, maybe a little bit lower than what you think their value is, and they're going to make a tremendous impact in the league. PhD, give me one.
Yeah, so sorry, touched on one. Killed Kirkpatrick from Alabama, who went to the Bengals at 17. But my top steal would be Brandon Weeden at 22. Cleveland Browns were able to pick him up. And I think whenever you can pick up a guy that can realistically step in and start from day one, and he's a late first-round pick, I think that's a win. That's a victory. That's a good thing. That's strong. All right, I'll stop with adjectives, but, you know, when you pick up Whedon, 22nd pick, plug him in, hopefully they can move Colt McCoy and get something back in return. So Brandon Whedon was certainly my my steal of the draft.
Okay, okay. D. Wills, who's your steal?
Mine is Courtney Upshaw, who went to the Ravens. He went at 35. I thought he was probably a lower first-round pick. And he's the kind of guy that's going to be able to play multiple positions for the Ravens. And people are going to look back on him and be like, how did he drop to the second round? And some of people are saying about his pass rushing, his size. But I just think, so, you know, Ravens know how to pick these linebackers, kind of like the Steelers. They know how to find guys. And I just think that this is a guy that's going to energize the Raven defense.
All right. So a guy I kind of looked at as a late round steal, and that was Tremaine Johnson, the corner taken by the Rams, second pick in the third round. This is a guy who, if not for being at a small school, he's at Montana, out of the University of Montana, is a guy that I think would have gone in the first round, a first round talent. But I think there are questions about that transition from a small school into playing against the pro and playing into the pros. He's a guy I think is going to step in right away. He's going to help in the nickel package. And I think we're going to see him over the next couple of years become one of the better corners in the league. I think he has that kind of talent and that kind of potential. So I think Tremaine Johnson was a good pickup, was a steal for the St. Louis Rams in the third round. Now, players who were taken too high, they were taken too doggone high.
I'm screaming for the ball. I'm screaming for the rock.
Thank you. Taking a run with it. You got it.
Ryan Tannehill. I couldn't say it fast enough. You know, I'm that guy in the back of the room. Third grade. Teacher asks a question. I'm stretching out saying, me. Call me. Ryan Tannehill. Number 8. Come on now. Come on, man. Are you serious? With all these questions. Who takes a project at number 8? A project who, in the best case scenario, would be a solid starting quarterback. Now, it's one thing to take a project, you know, what we perceive as a project last year with Cam Newton, because he had so much upside. But with Tannehill, we're taking him at 8. He's a top 10 pick, and we don't even really know when he's going to play. They're projecting maybe you get on the field second, third year. So for me, this is a guy that was clearly taken a bit too high.
Okay. I'm going to jump in here. I know you had this as one of your steals. I had this as a guy who I felt was taken way too high, and that's Brandon Whedon. I think he's a good quarterback, but I think that's what he's going to be. He's going to be a good quarterback. He's going to be a decent quarterback, I think. You know, it's a quarterback-driven league, and you can almost go through a team's schedule, and game to game, whoever has the best quarterback, most of the time that team is going to win. And I don't think he's a top half of the league quarterback. I think he's a good quarterback, but I don't think he's a top half of the league quarterback. And I felt like Cleveland could have filled another need there. Even if they weren't sold on Colt McCoy, I think they could have got Whedon a little bit later, maybe in the second round with their second round pick. You know, I just feel like they could have got him at another time. I think at 22, I was a bit shocked and surprised when they took him that high. I'm just not that high on him. Again, I could be wrong. I don't claim to be a quarterback expert or anything like that. He just wasn't somebody that I was really excited about. And I agree with the Tannehill pick. To me, that just doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's a lot of what ifs when you have an opportunity to take a guy in the top 10. Way too many ifs, way too many question marks. And I just felt with Whedon, I think he's either gonna hit or he's going to miss. Because at 28, there's not a whole lot of wiggle room with a guy at that age as far as development. Because you got about 7-8 years, and then he's 36, 35. And if he hasn't figured it out, you know, by year 3, then you kind of got to scrap the whole project and you're starting all over. And you don't really have a whole lot of wiggle room with a guy like that. So that would be my concern with Wheaton. D. Wills.
It's Tannehill. There is at number. I mean, there's no other discussion. I don't think there's anybody close in the race. I think there's too many other quarterbacks that Miami could have looked at in this draft, gotten some value in some other places. They have a quarterback in Moore who demonstrated he played well down the stretch. Maybe you go and get some of these other quarterbacks that they had to draft that went a little bit second or third round to add some value. You get another player that could probably add something at number eight who could definitely be a starter coming in day one and add to a team that played pretty well down the stretch last year. If you had a rookie who could be an impact, that could take you over the top and kind of push things. So I just think this is too much of a reach at eight.
Okay, so let's move on to our number four in the topic, in the five on the black-hand side. And real quick, so, again, we don't like to do immediate grades on this year's draft, but what we like to do here is we like to go back. So we're going to go back 4 years and look at the 2008 draft because it's not till about 3 or 4 years later you really know what you got. So I'm going to give the guys my top 10 hits at number four from the draft of 2008. So when I say hits, these are guys who made good on their draft position. So either they were a high-round pick who made good and who lived up to the hype and lived up to the investment, or they're a lower-round pick who has come along and really shocked folks. All right, so this is my top 10. At 10, I got Jermichael Finley. Now, Finley was taken in the fourth round in 2008 out of Texas. And I would say today he's arguably a top five tight end in the league, one of the most athletic tight ends we've seen in the league in the last couple of years. So I think Finley has definitely outplayed and outperformed his draft position. At number nine, I have Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie, an excellent corner. Played very well his first couple of years in the league. Got a little bit lost in the shuffle in Philly last year, but I think that was just because they had three guys who they were paying a lot of money and had a lot invested in, and they were trying to figure out how to make that work. But DRC is definitely a solid, excellent cornerback who I think is going to continue to have a very good career. At number seven, at number eight, Jordy Nelson. Again, this is a guy who was taken in the second round of the draft and has performed at a first-round level, had one of the best seasons of a wide receiver in the Packer uniform last year, just an excellent wide receiver all the way around, one of Aaron Rodgers' favorite receivers, number one targets. Then at number seven, Matt Forte, running back for the Chicago Bears, all-purpose back, can catch the ball out of the backfield. He was also taken in the second round of the 2008 draft, has definitely played beyond that draft position. He arguably is one of the top five backs in the NFL, was playing at a very high level, had that team on its way to the playoffs last year before he and Jay Cutler got injured. Then looking at offensive tackle for the Denver Broncos, Ryan Clady. Again, he's taken in the first round. But has definitely lived up to that potential, has been to a Pro Bowl, has played very well protecting the blind side of the luminaries that the Broncos have trotted out at quarterback in his tenure. from Kyle Orton to Tim Tebow, he's kept them clean. And then one of the biggest steals of the draft, sixth-round pick, Carl Nix at number five. Carl Nix just signed with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers after playing his first couple of years with the New Orleans Saints. One of the best guards in the league, was taken in the sixth round and has definitely definitely been named to the Pro Bowl, been named an All-Pro, has definitely lived up to that potential and more. And has really made a name for himself as one of the elite guards in the league. Then, at number four, we got CJ2K. Chris Johnson taken late in the first round, 2,000-yard running back, had a rough year last year after holding out, is looking to bounce back, has some O-line problems in Tennessee, but I think he's definitely one of the top 10 guys in his class. Number three, Jake Long. He was the number one pick in the 2008 draft. I have him at number three. Jake is an all-pro. He's an all-pro bowl caliber player. He's also the cornerstone of that Dolphins offensive line. Right now, that franchise seems a bit out of whack as far as trying to figure out what they want to do, hence our criticism of the Ryan Tannehill pick. But Jake is a solid pick that they made, and he's definitely lived up to the expectations of being a number one pick. When you take a tackle, offensive lineman that high, you expect him to be a rock and a source of stability for your program, for your franchise for 10 to 12 years. And I think he's well on his way to being exactly that for the Dolphins. At number two, I have Ray Rice. Ray was taken in the second round, two-time Pro Bowl, two-time All-Pro, three straight 1,000-yard seasons. Has just been a very versatile all-purpose back. Has really helped the Ravens solidify themselves on offense and become a more balanced team. I think he's more responsible than that than Joe Flacco. And actually, Ray needs to get the ball way more than he does. And then at number one, I got Matt Ryan, Offensive Rookie of the Year, Pro Bowler. Just came off his first 4,000-yard season. I think when Atlanta took him, where they took him, he has been what they have expected. Now, can he continue to take that next step in his growth process and really become an elite quarterback? We'll still wait and see. But I think right now Atlanta has to be happy with what they've gotten from him. He has a very strong record as a starter. Has taken him to the playoffs, I think, 3 out of 4 years. I put Matt Ryan at number one out of this class. If we were redrafting this class today, I think this is how the first round, the first 10 picks may go. So, guys who were top 10 picks who I left out. Let me just pull it up real quick. Because there are some guys who are top 10 picks who I definitely left off. There are actually a lot of what I would call a lot of misses in this draft. When we look back as far as that first round and those first 10 picks. The top 10, we had Jake Long at number one to the Miami Dolphins, Chris Long at number two to the St. Louis Rams, Matt Ryan at number three to Atlanta Falcons. Number four was Darren McFadden to the Oakland Raiders, the Kansas City Chiefs to Glenn Dorsey at number five, the New York Jets to Vernon Golston at number six, the New Orleans Saints to Seth Ellis at number seven, the Jacksonville Jaguars to Derek Harvey at number eight, the Cincinnati Bengals took Keith Rivers at number nine, and the New England Patriots took Gerard Mayo at number 10. So, that's my top 10. Guys who I had kind of on the outside looking in, the next five guys I had were Run DMC, Darren McFadden, Joe Flacco, Gerard Mayo, Calais Campbell, who was defensive tackle for the Arizona Cardinals, taken in the second round, and then Pierre Garçon. So those were my next five.
Yeah, I think you had a good list. I might put Chris Johnson. I could buck him for that number one spot and push. If you just talk about straight holdout withstanding, I think given where he drafted and what he means in the league in terms of just his what he's garnished as just a superstar in the league in terms of what he's done, I would say, to me, that's a little bit more. I see his brand being a little bit more brighter than Matt Ryan.
I agree, but this is football and running backs are dime a dozen.
I'm not saying that Chris Johnson, but he's exception to the rule. If we look at this class,
I don't think so. I don't think he's an exception to the rule at all. If he has a 12-year career at the production then he's an exception to the rule.
You talk about looking at where they are now. Chris Johnson is, in terms of his output for what he's doing, his position, where he's in the league, I see him much higher than Matt Ryan.
Nah, I don't. I know. How many times have the Titans made the playoffs with Chris Johnson? How many years have they made the playoffs with Chris Johnson?
I'm saying when you're evaluating the success of these players from where they were drafted and what they're doing now, you're talking about, you know, their record-breaking performances.
Yeah, and that's what running backs do.
But that's not all running backs.
Well, I mean, when you're talking long-term.
I'm just saying, you're talking about grading it right now. If you were doing it right now, Chris Johnson, a whole bunch of teams.
Yeah, as of right now, we don't know if we got two more good years of Chris Johnson.
I'm not saying
that.
If you're looking at that draft and you're saying where we are today, I put Chris Johnson ahead of Matt Ryan. I'm just saying that.
Well, let's look at the results that the Titans have got, okay? What have the Titans got out of Chris Johnson?
I'm adding to there's a whole bunch of factors to that. But when you talk about the electrifying of Chris Johnson, what people view for him in the league and his explosiveness and when people talk about it, they talk about him in ways that elevate him, in my way, above Matt Ryan. I'm just saying at this point. I think Matt Ryan is a bunch of smoke and mirrors right now.
And he might be. He might be. But
Matt
Ryan
not talking about that.
And I agree with you. I think Matt Ryan still has a lot to prove. I think he still has a lot to prove.
I didn't say I would put him at 2, 3, or 4. I just said I would put him at the top of your list. I just said I would put him at 2, 3, or 4.
Who was that, Ryan?
Yeah. Then you have Ryan at number one.
I put him at the top because I felt like
I would argue that Michael Finley might be at the top of your list over Matt Ryan in terms of just where they are for where he was drafted and what he's viewed in terms of his position in the game and as a superstar. I might argue that Michael Finley over Matt Ryan.
Nah, I wouldn't say that. Again, we're talking about football, D.
We're talking about football. We're talking about quarterback.
Where did Ryan Tannehill get drafted?
Look. Listen, we're talking about practice. Not a game. We're talking about practice.
You got Ryan with number 3 in that draft. And I would argue that it's been more hype than it's been anything else.
I don't know about that. So since the 2008 draft, the Titans have been 13-3. They were 13-3 in 2008. In 2009, they were 8-8. In 2010, they were 6-10. In 2011, they were 9-7.
There was a lot to do with that. That was a breakdown of the quarterback. It was a breakdown of that.
What I'm saying, when you're talking about
production, because Matt Ryan went in and had a lot to do with their defense, a lot of whole other pieces that they were running the ball. They were doing a lot of stuff to protect Matt Ryan. He wasn't winning games.
If you're the Dolphins and you got the number one pick in that draft, you're taking Matt Ryan. Why? Because if you put the things you need to put around him, he's going to win for you. With Chris Johnson, he can rush for 2,000 yards and you're still going to be 500. He can have one of the greatest seasons in the history of a running back and you're still 500.
But I'm not convinced Matt Ryan is a Super Bowl quarterback. You ride that whole thing. I'm
looking at what he's done. I'm going off of what he's done and the wins that he's got. This is all fact.
I'm saying to you, it's your list. I'm just saying I don't think it's a list.
That's the first one tonight, folks. That's the first. It's your list. All I'm saying is I'm not riding for Matt Ryan one way or the other. I'm just going off the body of work that I have in front of me and how that impacted the success of the team that drafted him. And if the Falcons had taken PJ2K, they wouldn't have experienced the success that they've had. Now, is that all attributed to Matt Ryan? No, it's not. It's not all Matt Ryan, but Matt Ryan is definitely a key piece to their ability to win football games right now. Is he an elite quarterback? Is he in that top tier? No. He's a step below that. And he's still got some work to do. He's still got to climb over a Romo. He's still got to climb over Philip Rivers.
Flacco got more playoff wins than Ryan.
Who?
Flacco got more playoff wins than Ryan. Ain't that your boy? Flacco got more playoff wins than Ryan. I could argue Flacco won more games on his shoulders to get his team over the hump than Ryan has in the playoffs.
And that's true. And Chris Johnson hasn't won any.
But I'm saying it's just electrifying players that they are exceeding what anybody thought. If I were ranking, and maybe I'm setting my rankings up in a different way, so that might be my problem is. But if I'm talking about just electrifying, like they perform in ways that we never imagined they would perform, he has. He's the eye popper. If you're saying who's the potential Hall of Famer, he's closer to the Hall of Fame than any of those.
So Matt Ryan, in his
Who's closer to a Hall of Fame player, Matt Ryan or CJ?
Neither one of them. The only thing CJ's got is that 2,000-yard season. That's it. We've seen running backs that CJ 2K is not even at Jarrell Davis' level. He's not even at Jarrell Davis' level yet.
I'm going to tell you, if he just has one season close to that, he might not be a first ballot. But he might secure a Hall of Fame.
Nah, he won't. Terrell Davis ain't getting in.
CJ2K
ain't getting in.
In an era where you're not seeing that many running backs even get close to that, come on now.
I think it's too difficult for running backs right now, man. The impact that running backs have has been so devalued.
And that's why I said he's even valuable, because in the midst of all that, he's still performing. I say he's closer to the Hall of Fame than Ryan, but I digress. I will remember that next year when Ryan is playing. I'm going to be on him like Philip Rivers. So we need to mark the tape. Phil, team, we got to mark the tape on this one.
Market. Before we finish, I want to pull up CJ2K's stats real quick. I want to pull them up for a moment. I'm waiting on my dinosaur of a computer to get where it needs to be. I need to call the guys at Resistance Digital, man. This computer's way too slow. Larry, where
I'm
you at, man?
Here
on
you have a
I'm
thought
just
on
sitting here in the corner with my. I'm just sitting here with my arm braids for the past 10 minutes.
Go ahead, jump in, PhD, jump in.
Oh yeah, so I think it's Chris Johnson. I think if you're trying to decide who should be the number one pick, well, first of all, I think you still go with Jake Long. You go with the offensive lineman that's going to be 12 to 15 years, you know. But if the conversation is between Ryan and Johnson, I take Johnson number one. And I do think Johnson's a lot closer to a Hall of Fame type of career. You know, I mean, think about it. O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson was a first ballot Hall of Famer. Chris Johnson so far in his career has put up better numbers. You know, if you take O.J. Simpson's top 5 years or top 4 years, and you compare him to Chris Johnson's top 4 years, they're very comparable. So, you know,
Here's a question. Is Edgerrin James a first ballot Hall of Famer? Is Edge a first ballot Hall of Famer?
No.
Edgerrin's first 5 years, I guarantee, son Chris Johnson's first 5 years. Guarantee it. Edgerrin James had one of the best first 5 year starts of a career of any running back ever.
But what takes away from that is he's also on the team with Peyton Manning. That's what stings his stuff.
I'm talking about just off numbers. But what has Chris Johnson done, though? It's not like Chris Johnson is leading his team to the playoffs every year. Outside of just numbers, what has he done?
There's a lot of people in the Hall of Fame whose teams haven't been to the playoffs.
Right. So what I'm saying is outside of numbers, so if we're going off just numbers, Edge has had a better start to his career than Chris Johnson.
And that might be true.
With a pass happy quarterback.
For the fact
in a pass happy system.
But people are saying Chris Johnson had those numbers when he didn't even have a good quarterback. He had no offense. He still was producing those numbers.
He was in a run-first system, though.
But so that means there's nine people in the box, and he's still winning. Come on.
Yeah.
What is he winning?
Yeah,
he's getting yards.
But you can't care.
He's not winning
game.
No game.
He's still winning.
They went to the playoffs once.
I'll go back. Phil T, I'm going back to you. I'm going to let this young man have his list.
You play to win the game.
That's all. My point is that if Edgerrin James, if you don't consider Edgerrin James the first ballot Hall of Famer, I don't see how you can consider Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson has had more big runs, yes, but then you're choosing flash over substance.
Well, look at the impact that Chris Johnson had on the game, and just from a game planning standpoint, where teams, you know, it's almost like having Jordan on the field. You know, it's almost having like a young Randy Moss on the field, where every single play you have to make sure this guy is accounted for. You have to have two or three guys assigned to this cat, because all it takes. I compare Chris Johnson to Barry Sanders in terms of the effect that a defensive coordinator has to have to contain this guy. Because if you slip up, whether it's a screen pass, him coming out the backfield, we saw Barry Sanders have 15 carries for 22 yards in the first three quarters. Then he busts a 70-yard run, and now his numbers are looking like 20 carries, 120 yards. You know. Barry was not a grinded-out type of guy. He could just break it on you at any moment. And in some ways, that changed the whole dynamic of that Detroit offense. When he was there with Fonz, they had some of the best years. I mean, Scott Mitchell, heaven forbid, if my dad's listening, but Scott Mitchell had some career years. Look at Rodney Pete. Look at Chandler. I mean, look at some of those guys. And a lot of that had to do with defenses had to respect Barry Sanders. Even after the game, you look at his numbers. Now, if you take this last year away from Chris Johnson, which I think is kind of extenuating circumstances with the whole contract and everything else, you look at his first four years, I mean, he had a very, very solid run. And he needs to continue that. He needs to continue that run for another couple of years and be seriously considered, you know, for the Hall of Fame. But you look at this era of dual running backs, and here's a guy, 20-25 carries per game his first couple of years. To me, that speaks a little bit louder to numbers in terms of his impact on the game plan.
Yeah, I dig that. But it doesn't equate to wins.
But the thing about it is you don't game plan to stop Matt Ryan.
Yes, you do.
You don't. No, you don't.
Yes, you do.
You're not worried about Matt Ryan being.
Who are you trying to stop, man?
Nobody. Matt Ryan is. It's not like.
Who are you trying to stop, then? Who are you trying to stop? Who are you game planning to stop if you
game
plan against Atlanta?
You know that. Deep in your heart.
Who are you game planning to stop? If you're not trying to stop the opposing quarterback.
You don't pull yourself out to the deep water. You know deep in your heart. I'm going to talk to you offline. I'm going to talk to you in 3 months. And you're going to be like, I might have gone a little bit. You're going to listen to this tape, and you're going to say to yourself, nah, they don't really
stick to my guns on this one, man, because if anything else, it's more about the position. It's more about the position. It's the position of the quarterback right now is the most important position as far as determining who wins and loses football games. And Matt Ryan is still better than two-thirds of the league. He's not great. No, he's not. But he's still better than two-thirds of the quarterbacks in the league,
but I'm not sure if he's better than three
games, you got a shot.
As we move on, I'm not sure if he's better than Flacco in the same class.
I agree. I don't see a significant difference. Now we can argue that Ryan's better, Flacco's better, but I don't see a significant difference. I don't see a significant difference between those two. A significant difference. I don't see it.
In fact, Flacco got more playoff wins. I will leave it alone. I know we got to move on, y'all. This is hot and rich. I believe
we got. It's all on tape. It's all on tape. It's 2012.
That's
it's
right.
All on tape. It is all on tape. All right. So we have a little bit of time left. We're gonna go off the dome for a little bit, and then we're gonna get into the shutdown mode. A few things that kind of popped off this week. You guys are more baseball guys than I am, so I'm going to defer to you guys. And also, for you listeners out there, again, you're listening to Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, the Risk Gaze, the sports radio, RSG. We have a spinoff show, a brother show, Inside the Park, and they talk a lot of baseball. We're going to talk a little baseball right now. I'm going to throw it to the fellas. What's up with Albert? Is anybody explaining to me what's going on? I mean, we have one of the greatest hitters of a generation struggling a little bit out the gates. Is this something that we should be worried about, or is he going to figure it out and get it together? Anybody can take it.
I guess I'll jump in just quickly. I think he's going to right the ship. He's going to get better. The Angels' problem is that they are struggling in the bullpen, and that's been a big issue for them. So I think those are the things they got to fix around the pitching. But Albert, I think, is going to right his ship and get hot later on in the year. So I'm not as worried about it. I mean, they definitely got a problem because Texas is so far out ahead of them, I think. I don't know if it was 6-9 games or whatever. So they are, at this point, fighting probably for one of those wild card spots. But I would say that I'm more worried about other aspects of their team than Albert's performance.
PhD?
Yeah, I would agree. Albert, he had a pretty slow start last year, and he had a quote-unquote down year. Didn't hit just a hair under 300. At 299, 37 home runs, and 100 RBIs, and just under 150 ball games. So I'm not overly concerned. This year, obviously, it's a slower start. The thing about Albert that makes me not be overly concerned is his strikeouts are still down. They're a little bit higher than they normally are, but he's right around 90 to 100 at bats, and he only has about 14 strikeouts. So I can see Albert getting hot and still putting up some pretty solid numbers. So I'm not overly concerned about him. I think this does speak to what happens on the back end of his career. You know, if you can get 3 or 4 quality years out of him, the Angels might be in a really bad situation towards the back end of his contract.
Yeah, he's off to a very slow start. You know, I agree with you, fellas. I'm going to defer to you guys. I'm not a baseball guy at all. But what I do want to get into real quick is the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. All right, Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Again, Dog of the Week is brought to you by Resistance Digital. Hit them up at resistancedigital.com. Get those electronic needs. I'm going to need to hit them up for a new CPU. It's crazy. Crazy flow. Man, CPU slow as Tom Brady. All right. PhD.
We need more dogs.
So last week I reported that I was in the finals of fantasy football, of fantasy basketball. I had Linda from the dead. I was doing the Matambo, fetching the ball, eight seed, all the way to the championship, and I got out-coached. I got out-managed. You know, I made some strategic errors. My opponent, you know, I can't get a little Wayne, show me my opponent and start chewing on some chips. I can't do it. My opponent did me dirty. Out-coached me. They out-managed me. They set a trap, and I went right into it.
Hey, you were going to get a veteran.
Yeah, I got to tip my hat, and I'm just going to put it out there. The Game Changer's wife, the Game Changer's wifey, out-coached me. So that's it.
Hey.
Hats off.
Yeah, she was creeping, man. She was creeping the whole way, man. She's kind of like, okay, Phil making a lot of moves. She's like, I'm gonna let him keep going. I'm gonna let him waste up his. He must not know he only got four moves for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, I thought it was gonna reset on Sunday. You know, I thought it was gonna reset on Sunday because our last week is always, you know, about 10, 11 days. You know, instead of the normal 7 day week. And then I thought about it logically. I said, wait a minute. It was like Saturday. I said, wait a minute. It resets per season week, not calendar week. I think I'm in trouble.
Then it dawned on me. Houston, we have a problem. Yeah, she was excited about that, man. She knew she had you. She knew she had you. She knew she was going to get you. And Carmelo, you know, she had a team with Carmelo on it, and he balled out his mind that last month. So he really kind of carried her through to the him and Westbrook carried her through to the championship. But props to PhD for getting there as an AC, man. You know, me and speaking of which, D Wills, I need your keepers. But you can give me those. You can send me an email with that. I need your keepers.
Uh-oh. Okay, I'll let you know that.
Yeah.
I thought I did send them, but I will.
Maybe I missed them, but I need those. Amongst your keepers,
we need more dogs.
Well, I mean, first of all, Phil T, don't be ashamed because she put it on all of us. She got two-thirds of the three-man boot. So we tried to get past it.
Hey, I get it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Yo, which one of y'all did she give it to?
Oh, my goodness. So you know what I see her, I can't say much.
Which one of y'all got away?
I Hey. Well, my dog of the week, I actually had one coming in, and then we'll just have to look at it like this, that Ryan Braun, when he had three home runs and, one or two triples,
and
he went. And so he broke out, and I got to give him the dog. After everything he went through in the offseason to come out and put a performance like that. And then the second one is Andrew Bynum with the triple-double. This young man is coming into his own and is beginning to assert himself in these playoffs. And so those two are my dog of the weeks.
Okay. And I'm bringing up the caboose on the train.
More dogs.
Man, my dog of the week is J to the Z, man. I think the Nets have had him as part of their ownership team. He's a minority owner in the Brooklyn Nets, and he's been owned a small part of the team for, you know, the last couple of years. And I think they've been waiting to this day to really utilize his services. They unveiled their new logo, and, you know, it's come out to mixed reviews on the internet. I love it. I think it's cold. And the reason I think it's cold, I think the people that don't like it because it wasn't made for them. Jay-Z knew exactly what he was doing when he sat down with his designers and tried to come up with a logo that he would wear. Not the writer at the New York Post, not the writer on Time Magazine, not the bloggers on ESPN. He came up with a design of a hat that he would want to rock, of a logo that he could see on a hat, of a logo that he could see cats wearing in Brooklyn and representing the team. And that's what I like about the logo. It's very simple. The colors are black and white. It'll be interesting to see how they make that look on the jerseys. I like it. It's very simple. It's very classic, very simplistic. I like it. I'm gonna get me a Brooklyn Nets hat. I'm not a fan, but I like the design. I like the design a lot. If you haven't seen it, get on the internet, check it out. I like it. I think Jay-Z did good work with that. So dog of the week is Jay-Z. Have you guys seen the logo?
I haven't seen the logo. I'm going to check it out here soon.
Yeah, check it out real quick. Give me your impressions, quick impressions. We got a little bit of time.
Yeah, I like it. It's clean.
Yeah, very clean, man, very clean. Not a whole lot going on. Much better than Thunder's logo. I can't mess with that one. I don't know what's going on with that one. Ain't no thunder or nothing in it. Oh, man. So, real quick, as D-Will looks up the logo, PhD, can you give us a quick preview of what we have in store for the listeners next week?
Yes, sir. So tomorrow, and hopefully you all have checked out the Inside the Park show that Marcus just mentioned, that's led by Hank, RJ, and Mike. Tomorrow they're going to be talking about Dalman's Young, 7-game suspension. Talk about Bryce Harper, who just recently got called up to the majors, one of the top prospects of the game. And they'll also get into season-to-date type of review. So awesome show. It's a quick hitter, 60 minutes, seasonal, just during the baseball season. So great show. Hope you guys check in and listen to that. On our show next Tuesday, we have Alan Sack coming back. For those faithful listeners, you'll probably remember Alan was on our January 10th show to open up our year. And Alan is a professor at New Haven. He was a member of the 1966 Notre Dame National Championship team. And he is, if I had to describe Alan in one word, he is an advocate for student athletes' rights. Similar to Ramadi Huma, who was on a couple of weeks ago, Alan Sack wrote an excellent book called Counterfeit Amateurs. And so he's coming back for round two. Whenever we get Alan, we like to just kind of clear it out and give Alan the floor. So he'll be on for a good 30 minutes with us. Also, Justin Page, our emerging NBA analyst, will be on as well to give us some feedback on what's going on with the NBA playoffs. So, fellas, that's what we have coming up in the next 7 days on the Real Sports Guys Network.
All right.
Playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. You kidding me?
I had to throw a little more in there. Oh, man. Hey, I gotta upload that clip, man, of we had a conversation about Bryce Harper a couple years ago, man, and Ray dropped one on us, man. Ray was like, hey, that boy looked like Shrek. He was talking about how big his head is and everything, man. Good old Ray, man. We got to get Ray back in the mix, man. We got to get Ray back in the mix.
And Game Changer, I looked at the logo. Love it. It's for Brooklyn. It's for New York. It's something that Jay-Z would rock. I love it. It's simple. It's what it needs to be.
Yeah, I agree, man. That franchise needed a different look, to take things in a different direction. Like I said, it is the circle basketball logo looks nice on a fitted, man. It looks nice on a new era.
Yeah,
and that's what he was going for. I think, you know, when you look at the merchandise that they got out there, the track jacket, it's perfect. It's perfect. I like it. I like it. It's simple. It's not too much. It's just enough. I dig it. It's swagged out. It's swagged out. I'm gonna give me some Brooklyn Nets gear. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I think you'll like it too. Again, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys on RealSportsGuys.com. We're heading into the final moments of the show. About to transition into our after hours portion. As we get ready to do that, we have a section of the show that we call the shutdown. This is where we shut down a bit of whackness that we see invading the sports world or the sports radio world. We want to shut it down. We want to vanquish all whackness. So I'm going to talk to my man D. Wills. What you shutting down this week?
I'm shutting down, you know, all this talk about LeBron and everything else. I believe, and I've been one of the biggest, you know, I think people in terms of being critical of LeBron, but I think that they are going to put it on folks this year. So y'all need to go to sleep on that talk. I think the Heat gonna finish it.
My man, PhD, what you shutting down this week, man?
I'm shutting down NBA professional teams that lose a 27-point lead in the playoffs. Memphis, get it together. Get it together, Memphis.
Oh, man. It's hard out there for a pimp. Hey, man, I'm shutting down the Shanahan, man. Kyle, and Jeff, man. How y'all going to draft RG3, trade all his picks to draft RG3 second, and then going to draft Kirk Cousins in the fourth round? What kind of sense would that make, man? You don't see the Colts doing nothing stupid like that? This is what I talked about last week when I said, who going to mess this up for RG3, the organization? I'm shutting that down right now. I'm calling it right now, man. If RG3 ain't successful, man, a chunk of the blame has to go on that organization. They already mishandling this situation. Why are you going to draft another quarterback? I don't know. That just made me mad when they did that, man. Just made me mad. If you don't believe in RG3, why you trade all them picks for them? That's just my perspective on the situation. So that's the shutdown for this week. We have After Hours coming up. In After Hours, we're going to talk some boxing, okay? We're going to talk to B-Hop. Chad Dawson fight. We're going to talk the Mayweather-Cotto fight. So for all you live listeners out there, you're going to miss that. But if you download the show, download the podcast onto your iTunes, you can catch that boxing conversation that we're going to have. And I'm sure it's going to be very lively. We like to talk boxing on this show. So make sure you stay tuned or make sure you download that so you can catch that conversation. Again, you're listening to The Real Sports Guys. We thank you for listening tonight. We appreciate your patronage. Hope you come back. Hope you had a good time. Hope you want to come back next week. Any parting shots, fellas? We have a couple minutes.
What were we going to say?
Game changers went a little bit early in the second base, you know?
Hey, I'm in standing up, though.
Stand up,
yeah, yeah. I mean, he did the Willie Mays thing. From Major League, you know.
They came up a little short of the base.
I got a parting shot. I'd like to send a shout out to Bynum for 10 blocks in the opening playoff game matchup. And also, I want to send a shout out to old Roy Hibbert. Roy Hibbert doesn't look like a star, but he had 9 blocks. He literally had the same exact numbers, almost identical numbers. To buy them, but we just didn't talk about it because he's Roy Hibbert.
When your last name Hibbert, you got to figure something out, man. You got to work it out when your last name's Hibbert. People aren't really going to be looking to talk about you.
You have to work through it. Work through it a little bit.
Oh, man.
Oh, my goodness. Well, my parting shot is it's been good to be in this game with y'all. We're doing something special. So, I love it.
Yeah, man, I'm appreciating it. We appreciate the listeners out there. I appreciate the other two Thursday Electric Street Man booth. Appreciate y'all hanging with us. Biggie's going. That means it's time for us to go. Into After Hours. So again, you live listeners, we appreciate you listening to us tonight and hope to come back next week. Be well, be blessed, take it easy, take care. Peace. right, welcome to the After Hours section. You're on with the Real Sports Guys, RSG Renegade Radio, www.realsportsguys.com. Whew, fellas, let's talk a little boxing. Let's talk a little boxing. Yeah. Yeah, so, Bernard Hopkins, Chad Dawson fought this weekend. Dawson won by decision. D-Wills, impressions of the fight?
I think that, Hopkins' best opportunity when I was looking at this fight was to try to get it ugly and get Dawson out of his game early. There was a point probably in about the third round or so where it looked like Dawson was getting frustrated. I think, I don't know if that's when the headbutt happened, but he seemed you saw him grow. And that's what a veteran fighter like Hopkins will do for a young fighter like Dawson, is this moment where they get away from the physical skills and they start thinking game. And I thought that Dawson's cornerman, his trainer, did a really good job of really walking him through that maturity, which is important. I scored the fight 119-111. I think two of the judges scored it like 117-111, and one judge was watching another fight. He must have his back turned or watching someone. He scored it like 114-114, and you know that's the boardwalk. But you know, it's just amazing that B-Hop is even in the discussion at his age. And so, you know, he was competitive, but I just think, you know, the youth and the athleticism and the jab, he couldn't do the things that he did to win the belt with Dawson. I mean, Dawson had the skills and the ability to kind of work around those normal things that B-Hop would do to frustrate you.
Yeah, I think we all have to take our hats off a bit to B-Hop for just being able to fight at 5 million years old. You know, I hope I'm beating people up when I'm almost 800. But yeah, PhD, your thoughts?
Almost 800. All right, Bernard Hopkins, he's 47. But in boxing years, he's about 800. I get it.
Yeah.
So, what was the funniest thing to me was after the fight when Chad Dawson was trying to be respectful but also call out Hopkins, you know, Bernard's a legend, but he's dirty. But he is a legend. He is a legend. But, man, he's so dirty, you know. But I got to take my hat off to Bernard Hopkins, you know. He's laid the ground for fighters like me. But man, he dirty. You know? Chad was a little conflicted. He was very conflicted, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to be critical. If somebody was hitting me upside the head for 36 minutes, I might not all be there either. So, bad Chad, you know, he did his thing. Honestly, I think Hopkins faked it a little bit with the shoulder when they fought this past fall. And, you know, Dawson was declared the winner, but it got reviewed a few days later, and they took the belt away from Dawson. So, you know, Dawson did his thing. He beat him fair and square. And if I'm Dawson, don't fight Hopkins again. Don't do it. Just don't do it.
Because he's dirty. I respect
him.
He's dirty.
But this is greatness. Hopkins left the arena like he was robbed. That's the amazing thing about it. You know, they say, well, you know, Bernard left the arena. He didn't want to honor, you know, accept an interview. He left like it was close and he got robbed. I mean, that's what's made him great. That even when it was clear he lost, he left the arena like he got robbed. Like that 114-114 was really right. And that
right.
was wrong. That's what makes him so great. That I love. It feels like I've been watching him for half my life, you know. So it's just, when he retires, it's going to be sad because that's going to be a hole that we've been missing in the fight game.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, now, in the fight itself, I felt like Dawson, I think the challenges Dawson had with dealing with the tactics that B-Hop was using. I think it actually worked against B-Hop because it kept Dawson engaged because he was constantly mad. Like, man, this dude is cheating. You know, it's like that. You get upset at the fact that you feel like you're being, you know, that this guy is dirty, you know. And I think Dawson was feeling that way throughout the fight. Like, yo, man, because every time they would have a break, you know, you could see Dawson kind of looking at dude like, come on, man, can you just stop with it? You know, just kind of looking at him like, come on, bro, cut it out. But I think that kept Dawson engaged, and Dawson was able to channel that in a way that he didn't let it frustrate him. It kept him engaged in the fight so that he did, because Dawson can have lulls when he fights. He can get into a little bit of a lull where he has a couple of rounds where he's not really there. He's fighting, but he's not really engaged and really in that chess match like he should be. And I think what Hopkins was doing to him was crowding him. You know, he catch him on the way up, you know, rub against that eye, catch him against the temple on his way up. He crowd him low and then come up at him. And he was constantly getting him with the back of his head as he's coming up through his defense. Hey, I respect him, but he's dirty.
Yeah, that cut on his eye, that bad Chad got on his eye from the headbutt, the inadvertent headbutt from Hopkins was, I mean, that was a nasty cut. It was pretty deep. And so when that happened,
it
happened pretty early. And that was in the third or fourth round deep. And so I thought, okay, that might be his unraveling. Then he got a cut on his other eye, you know, and so now I'm thinking like I'm Raekwon back in the day. Holyfield cut his eye. He cut his eye. You know, and so I'm thinking, so I'm thinking like, wow, this thing might get stopped. But Chad, he remained focused, and you see the cut guy that he had. He has the same cut guy, the old school cat, that Floyd has on 24/7. So, you know,
with all the pins on his beret.
That's right.
What did you think of the situation where they kind of tackled each other?
Yeah, you thought, okay, here we go again with that.
I agree, and I
think, you know, where this played, like I said, this played, the tactics might have played against Hopkins, because against Pascal, Hopkins used those tactics. But reason why it worked is because Pascal wasn't a disciplined, sound fighter. That he won as being a very aggressive fighter, but his punches were very wide open, and so someone like Hopkins can counter that easily. With Dawson is, no one's ever questioned Dawson's skill. What they question is his focus. So he's going to punch straight. He's going to be crisp. He'll be in position most times, and so you're not going to catch him for the most part using wide punches. And so when he engaged him, the way he was punching was technically sound. That's the first time in a while that, and they talked about this, that B-Hop was going to get somebody that had that skill set. And the only thing he was hoping is that he could frustrate him, versus someone like Pascal, when he won the belt, was somebody who didn't have the boxing pedigree, didn't go through all the years of amateur boxing, didn't have that crisp kind of boxing style, and he took advantage of that youth in the way that he couldn't do with Dawson. So I think that was a real difference in the fight.
Yeah, so, you know, and Hopkins took off. Hopkins took off after the fight. I mean, just bolted out of the ring. And what was up with two judges scored the fight. I think they had 117 to 111. I think both judges had 117, 111 in favor of Dawson. And then one judge had scored it even. Now, what was that about?
I told you, I scored it 119, 111. And the only rounds, if you sat back and looked at it, and I'm recapping, I'm actually pulling my card up, that where they were even close were round one, round two, where you, and then I think you might have given Hopkins possibly round 11. But that doesn't, I mean, there's no way that you could give Hopkins, as I look at my scorecard, you could probably argue for three rounds for Hopkins. So I'm trying to figure out where you get the other rounds. And there's nothing that he demonstrated that he would he was getting finished off in most of those rounds. So I don't know what that guy was. I mean, that sometimes is borderline suspension. That might warrant some type of warning or suspension. You can't be that far off.
Yeah. PAZ, what was your assessment, man? Okay. I agree. Totally.
Yeah.
So we got.
So I agree with Devon. I'm a rookie in the boxing game, but I knew enough that it was not an even fight.
Yeah, it did not at all. But that's boxing. That's a good discussion for another day. Regulation of boxing.
Yeah. Do you think that element of it hurts the sport a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hurting it with because you don't see those same kind of things happening in the MMA game, you know, as egregious and things like that. And there needs to be some type of control about the boxing. And also what hurts boxing is that they're not willing to do what, you know, MMA is done, and they haven't found ways to market and get it back out into free space to get some of the interest going. They need to get back on ABC, Wild World Sports, and, you know, get some real big fights. You know, somebody needs to it's something they'll never do, but you need to find a way to get a big fight out there, put pressure, because that puts pressure on doing this right. But they've had too many bad decisions in the last year. I mean, just some stuff that, you know, some people, and there's some decisions where people should just go on to jail for some of those decisions. So, literally, somebody should arrest them. Fraud.
In some ways, boxing. In some ways, boxing needs a cover boy. They need somebody who is marketable enough that one of the major three or four sports in this country will be willing to align with them. I mean, imagine if the biggest, right now, the biggest star in boxing is Pacquiao and Mayweather. Clearly, 1-2, 2-1. Put them however you want to. You know. Imagine if Mayweather was marketable and coachable enough where the NFL could align themselves with boxing. That's what boxing needs, because they have such a closed market right now. I mean, you got the boxing lovers. I mean, those are the people that are going to be with them thick or thin. And in some ways, I'm really scared that baseball is heading in that direction.
And I don't know if you saw earlier in that card, Seth Mitchell, who played at Michigan State University, actually came in with an American heavyweight. And, you know, he was, and I was texting this out, hitting people on Facebook, and all the Spartan folks were coming back at me. But, you know, he was on the ropes early in the fight. But he showed grit, heart, came back and knocked out Witherspoon. And this is a guy that has some charisma, has some heart, has some, particularly when that story about the Klitschko's, it's almost got a Rocky-esque piece to it. You know, the Klitschko's are dominating, you know, boxing in a sense. And you know, who is going to be that American star that's going to challenge him? And this guy, if you hear his interviews, has kind of right. So this is the kind of guy, I mean, boxing, no matter what you say, is a heavyweight sport. And it's at its best when it has a dominant American heavyweight. Because that is situated, I mean, that makes Mayweather's in the lower weights just, I mean, that's where people believe they have a golden age of boxing. When you have an American dominant heavyweight and then you have all these other divisions where things are happening. This guy is a diamond in the rough. I love the way he fights. I love his heart. I love his dedication. And he could be a star if they get him going the right way to battle the Klitschko's.
So speaking of big fights, Mayweather and Cotto coming up this weekend. You know, the 24/7 is going. You know, Mayweather's pissing people off, as he always does on 24/7. He really knows how to just, man, he just knows how to rub you the wrong way, man. But I love it though, man. I love it. I love everything about it, man. So going into the fight, where are we standing on this? If you want to put yourself out there publicly, feel free to. If you want to hold your reservations, please do so. I don't know where I'm going on this one, man. And this is my personal disclaimer and how I view it. Anytime you go into a Mayweather fight and you don't say you know where you're going, you're going for the other guy. Because Mayweather's undefeated. So if you thought Mayweather's going to win, you say Mayweather's going to win. But Mayweather's mouth just makes you want to see him get knocked out, man.
Yeah.
Mayweather's probably the better fighter, and I will admit that. But, man, I just want to see somebody knock him out, man. He talk too much.
Man, your whole family against Mayweather. I'm riding, dying with the Michigan man. I know where I fit. This is going to be one of his toughest fights because Cotto's like that kid on the basketball court who don't say much, but if you mess with him, he's going to dog you all day. It's that I think he cleansed himself with his recent victory, and so he's dangerous. But Mayweather, man, he lives and breathes this. And all that talking, people get caught up with all that talking, but nobody is better at his craft and preparation than Roger Mayweather and Floyd Mayweather.
Agreed.
They it's like a smoke screen. They get you looking away from all that stuff. If you really pay attention to it, I mean, nobody is better at the fight game in a pair than those two. And it's continuity. They don't change. Whereas Cotto's big thing is Cotto's got some good, he's got a good corner person, but he's never really had stability. And I think Mayweather's biggest strength is, as much as it looks like he's out of control, when it comes to boxing, they've had stability. And I think it'll get him over the hump in this fight.
Nah, I agree. Mayweather has that Kobe effect where it's like, as much as you don't like the guy, you have to respect his work ethic. You have to respect the love that he has for his sport. You have to respect the love that he has and the passion that he has for hard work and the dedication and all of the work that he puts into being great and that pursuit of greatness. I can appreciate that. I'd appreciate it more if he'd get down and get in the ring with Pacquiao, because then it really showed me something. But he ain't got nothing to prove to me. But, yeah, that's where I stand on Mayweather. PAD, how do you see this fight?
I tell you what, Cotto earned a lot of, like, he earned a lot of my respect when he beat Margarito, and you can just see the anger and resentment in his eyes when they announced he won, and he was just staring at Antonio from across the ring. You know, Antonio was smiling. Cotto just earned a lot of my respect. And so in some ways, I think of Cotto almost as an undefeated fighter. I mean, I think he has two official losses, but, you know, he lost to Margarito, and he had another loss right after that. But, you know, so I actually think Cotto can beat Mayweather. I do. I think he can beat him. But I don't know if he will beat him. I don't know. But Cotto was just, you know, I watched Max Kellerman's face-off with Cotto and Mayweather. And Mayweather was just so complimentary. I mean, like, he complimented this guy so much. They were civil. They were shaking hands. And so in some regards, Mayweather has a lot of respect for Cotto. Now, some people are saying that, hey, this might have to do with publicity. You know, Mayweather's trying to, you know, get people to watch the fight, but Mayweather wasn't running his mouth off like he was with Ortiz or Haddon. You know, there's a much higher level of respect there. In Cotto, you know, you watch these 24/7s, and it's, you purely have the villain, the irresponsible, the guy that is making it rain in the club, you know, the guy that's getting arrested over and over and saying, I'll just buy myself out, I'll buy the best legal team.
you know, that just does not learn from his mistakes. And then you got Cono, the family cat, the guy that just puts his head down and gets it done. And so in some regards, man, you know, I think Cotto is going to beat Mayweather.
Uh-oh.
At a minimum, I think we're I think we're going to see an epic fight, an epic fight that's going to lead to a rematch at a minimum. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say Cotto beats Mayweather.
Mm.
He said this may go down with the St. Louis Rams pick, but hey.
I don't know if it's bad for MVP, but I don't know if it's that far out there. Like I said, he's a year early.
We've got to take our conversation from Facebook to either Twitter or Facebook this weekend, gentlemen. So y'all can't be saying, we got to get this on Facebook or Twitter. We got to take this thing to another space where we use it, because there's going to be some talking going back and forth on this one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so make sure you check us out on Facebook or Twitter, Real Sports Guys on Facebook. Hit us up at Real Sports Guys on Twitter. We're going to be out there talking about the fight, and we love to interact with the fans, to our listeners. You know, so make sure you catch us. Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. Fellas, that's all we got for After Hours. We're going to let it roll. Listeners out there, again, thank you for downloading, checking us out on the podcast. Check us out again next week, same time, Tuesday nights, 8:30 to 10:30, Blog Talk Radio. Also, make sure you check out Inside the Park, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. Check out the fellas talking at Baseball Talk, your boys of summer. They're going to hold you down, get you all up to date on what's going on in the world of baseball. The RSG fam is growing by the minute. All right, we like the woo. We coming to take it take over. The bees are swarming. And we coming at you from all directions. Again, be well, be easy, be blessed. Take care. Peace.
I'm not laughing about it. You think this is funny? I take this serious.
I'm not.
I'm real serious. I put my heart and soul into this every single week.
All I'm saying is the camera shows.
I'm just telling you right now what I do every single week. Every single week. I put my freaking heart and soul into this. I study my ass off. I don't go out there and laugh. It's not funny. Nothing's funny to me. I don't want to go out there and get embarrassed.